Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is July 30th, 2020. This is the second of three oral arguments. My apologies, you cannot see me. This is Judge Peter Reyes. I am presiding judge, but I'm having difficulties in terms of the video, but I understand the audio that you should be able to hear me. So I just want to confirm with my colleagues, Judge Jennifer Frisch, can you hear me? Okay, so I had nod there.
Yeah, Judge yes, Michael, I can.
Okay, Judge Michael Kirk, can you hear me? Okay, so I had nod there as well.
Yes, I can.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for respondent, can you hear me?
Yes, Your Honor, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you. And then counsel for appellant, can you hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, perfect. We will be proceeding as usual in terms of the time, 15 minutes for appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, 5 minutes for appellant for rebuttal, if you so choose. We are holding these arguments virtually via WebEx. If we have several windows that you can see, including a window with a clock. So if you can see how much time that you have remaining to allocate your time accordingly. If for some reason either one of you have technical difficulties, if we cannot hear you at all, we will stop the clock, or if you keep talking and the clock is running, we'll certainly make sure that you have sufficient time. And either because you can't see me, one of my colleagues might actually indicate to you. I'll try to indicate verbally if there are issues with sound quality or video. We have found that at times, if the sound quality is not good, sometimes it actually helps by shutting off the video portion so we can still hear you, and the sound quality sometimes is better. So we may indicate that to you if that happens at some point, or communicate with you if there are other issues. There's also the chat function. So we have Pam on the line, so she can help with the IT issues. She's coordinating this for us. So with that, counsel for appellant, if you can please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Julian Zabot, and I'm an attorney with Maslin LLP, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Thomas Zick, James Zick, and Joyce Wilson. So if I may proceed.
Yes.
May it please the court, Your Honors, opposing counsel. Appreciate the court's time today during these brave new world that we're all living in, and certainly hope that the technological issues won't be any hindrance to today's argument. I've got a lot of ground to cover, and I want to be respectful of the court's time. In the appeals that are consolidated for hearing before the court today in the estate of Stanley Zick, I serve as appellate counsel. My clients, however, have been represented at all times by separate counsel in the underlying district court proceedings before the Honorable Charles Glassroot in Big Stone County. Now, by way of background, Judge Glassroot is the former law partner of the attorney, Lowell Nelson, who drafted the estate plan that was ultimately embraced by the district court in this matter. Following the judge's denial of my client's recusal motion prior to trial, the district court then issued in turn two post-trial orders, from which my clients now appeal, as well as from the original order denying their recusal motion. Due to the limited time for today's hearing and the amount of ground, as I noted, that I need to cover, unless Your Honors direct me otherwise, I intend to first address the recusal motion's denial and then turn to the district court's unauthorized and improper shifting of over $300,000 in attorney's fees onto my clients individually. I will then address the insufficient evidentiary record supporting the district court's findings that invalidated Stanley Zick's 2013 estate plan. And finally, if time permits, I will cover separately address the issue of the district court's determination of the estate's ownership of what has been referred to throughout these proceedings as the Wilson trailer.
So counsel, for yes. The recusal issue, nobody is disputing the underlying 2007 will, correct?
Correct, in terms of its validity. That's certainly not a disputed issue. Now, the validity is separate from whether the existence and the terms of that 2007 will have an impact on the district court's analysis with respect to the validity of the 2013 will. As I think respondents' counsel argued below and will likely argue today, or at least would concede today, surrounding circumstances, including the existence of prior estate planning, are relevant potentially to an evaluation of both the issue of lack of capacity as well as undue influence.
But it's really the subsequent will that is the focus of the litigation here. It's not the 2007, and you never even called the attorney who drafted the 2007 will to testify, correct?
Correct. Trial counsel did not call Mr. Nelson, Attorney Nelson, to testify. And your Honor is certainly correct that the validity of the 2007 estate plan or the will was not in question within this litigation. However, as I think if your Honor were to review the district court's August 2019 order, particularly paragraphs 38 and 39, the task that the district court necessarily undertook in evaluating the 2013 estate plan's validity involved a direct comparison of the respective estate plan's provisions, and in a very real sense, a determination of their reasonableness with respect to one another. In light of this analysis, I think it's fair to say that a reasonable observer might very well and probably would, in fact, question whether Judge Glassroot could fairly decide the will contest claims. Now, of course, there's an even larger issue looming over the district court's failure to grant the recusal motion. That motion was fully briefed, argued, and submitted before being summarily denied on the record at a pretrial motion hearing that the district court conducted back in November 2018. The issue raised by that motion is relatively simple, and it's set forth in the Powell decision that's cited, I think, in both of the parties' briefing. And that issue is, or that question is, would an objective examination of the surrounding facts and circumstances cause a reasonable observer to question Judge Glassroot's impartiality in this matter? The test is not, as respondents have periodically suggested, actual bias, and it's not actual prejudice. I think there's some confusion in the case law that they lay out. But
the district court did lay out the proper standard as well, that and apply the proper standard. So it doesn't really matter what respondents are arguing.
Well, your Honor, I think you're correct in the sense that when you look back at that the transcript of that November 2018 hearing, which really contains the only record of the district court's analysis and disposition of that motion, that Judge Glassroot did correctly cite the provision, the applicable provision of the Code of Judicial Conduct, which is rule or code provision 2.11, I would disagree with any suggestion that he in fact applied or properly applied that standard. As his statements on the record at that November 2018 hearing indicated, he in fact applied a different standard in denying the motion, one that in fact I would argue has no basis in Minnesota law and therefore by itself constituted an abuse of his discretion. After he first stated on the record that he would take the motion under advisement so that he could carefully consider the issues raised, because he certainly, I think, acknowledged at the hearing that these were significant and weighty issues that were being raised, he, minutes later, summarily denied the motion on two grounds. And those grounds were, first of all, that he had previously disclosed his relationship with the drafting attorney, Mr. Nelson, and then secondly, that it would be unfairly prejudicial to the estate's ongoing administration if he recused himself at that particular juncture in time. And, I think if the court carefully parses through that transcript, you see what happens between his initial statement that he's going to take the matter on advisement and then his summary denial a few minutes later is that he realizes that there are a number of administrative issues that the personal representative is now putting before the court. And I think he felt, frankly, pressured to make a decision.
Well, first of all, counsel, we review this, as you noted, on our abuse of discretion standard. Second of all, we have reviewed the transcript. And while he does make those statements, the district court also highlights the fact that he needed to avoid even the appearance of impropriety, and that he would need to disqualify if his impartiality might be called into question at all. And that he actually concluded by saying, I believe it's too attenuated, and so I'm going to stay in the case. So he did look at whether or not he would meet the standard of impartiality being questioned. So I'd like to, you don't have much time left. I'd like you to turn, actually, if you could, to really one of the key issues, and that's the testamentary capacity, because I think that's one of the key issues here in this case.
Certainly, Your Honor, I'm happy to do so. Making the argument that the district court's findings as to testamentary capacity, undue influence, are clearly erroneous. I acknowledge that this court is generally loath to revisit factual determinations made following a trial. Here, however, I believe there's good reason for this court to take a long, hard look, as Your Honors will undoubtedly do and probably already have, at the findings that the district court made as to the validity of that 2013 estate plan that Stanley Zick executed. If the court does so, and again, I have no reason to assume that you won't, I believe that it'll be left with the definite and firm conviction that a mistake was made. And this is because respondents contested that 2013 estate plan on the basis of lack of capacity and undue influence. Notwithstanding the apparent confusion in their briefing as to who carried the burden of proof in establishing those will contest claims, they, as the contestants, carried the heavy burden of proving both of those claims, not by a mere preponderance of the evidence, but by clear and convincing evidence. And that's a burden that I would submit to you they failed to meet. Here, the evidentiary record before the district court fails to support the findings by clear and convincing evidence that's required. And of course, you know, this is an issue that was briefed at some length. I think we went up to, you know, the word count limit in our opening brief. I mean, it's obviously a very fact-intensive argument. In particular, though, for purposes of today's argument, I want to really focus this court's attention on three what I consider very remarkable aspects of the district court record, which get completely overlooked by the district court in making the findings that it did. First of all, the lack of any medical evidence establishing that Stanley lacked capacity in 2013. Secondly, the district court's seeming complete disregard of drafting attorney William Lutner's trial testimony, which bolstered supported the conclusion both that Stanley had capacity, fully understood and appreciated what he was doing, and was not unduly influenced in signing the documents that he signed. And finally, the existence of a perfectly logical and reasonable basis for the changes that were reflected in the 2013 estate plan.
So, counsel, working those the three arguments, and sure, that follows tracks pretty closely with your briefing, the logical reasoning, that's something that's argued to the district court, and the district court rejected that argument. So why should we even revisit that? And second, with respect to the testimony, we give great deference to the credibility determinations, and the district court actually specifically said that oftentimes clients are counseled and coached fairly well by lawyers, and it can be a challenge sometimes to determine who's being truthful and who is not, who is credible and who's not. The district court made it very, very clear that as to who he believed and who he did not believe, and we give strong deference to those credibility determinations, and the district court can credit certain testimony from a witness and not credit others, or completely discredit testimony from a witness. Finally, we look at the factual findings. We review on appeal. We review in a way to support the district court's findings. And particularly on this issue, you point extensively to other testimony or other evidence, but that's not the lens that we view the evidence in. We view it in light most favorable to the district court's decision. So viewing it in the light most favorable to the district court's decision, how are the district court's findings of fact clearly erroneous? I didn't see that briefing at all on that particular, on the testamentary capacity issue.
Thank you for raising both of those issues, and I'll try to address them in turn. First of all, as to the credibility question, Your Honor is correct. I mean, the district court made, you know, fairly extensive findings regarding the individual parties' respective credibility. That being said, the evidence that the district court overlooks or outright ignores in making the findings that it did as to the issues of lack of capacity and undue influence don't rely in any way, shape, or form on the court, or this court, for that matter, crediting my client's testimony. All of the record evidence that we rely on, that we cite, and that we contend shows, even when viewed through the proper lens, as Your Honor points out, you know, again, it has to be viewed in the context of the very heavy burden that respondents bore during the trial, which was proving their claims not by a preponderance of the evidence, but by clear and convincing evidence. And looking at the record as a whole, even giving deference to the credibility determinations that the district court made, the district court essentially overlooks or ignores the neutral third-party testimony provided not only by attorney William Lutner, but also the two witnesses to the will, as well as the caretaker, Cindy Cole, who testified about her own conversation with testator as he went to the attorney meetings.
But again, that's up to the district court. Even if they're neutral, the district court has its discretion as to whether or not it's even going to credit any of that testimony. We only look to see if there's evidence in the record to support the district court's decision. We don't look at it to try to attack it and see where the district court may have failed to consider other evidence.
I understand the point you're making, Your Honor, but I would submit that it has to be that's a determination that needs to be made in light of the evidentiary burden. I think it's entirely notable.
But the evidentiary burden doesn't require the district court to weigh evidence that it has determined to be not credible. I mean, if the district court says the evidence is not credible, then it can disregard the evidence.
Correct, Your Honor, but in this particular instance, the evidence that we are contending the district court overlooked was not evidence that it decided or expressly found to be lacking in credibility. It found the testimony of certain of my clients to be lacking in testimony, but that, frankly, the arguments that are fully briefed before this court on this appeal are not reliant on their testimony.
Right, but the district court doesn't even have to say what it doesn't credit. The district court can just say, I credit this testimony, I credit that testimony. And as long as there's record evidence to support that testimony, we don't question that on appeal at all.
I understand, Your Honor, but I would submit that the record evidence still needs to meet that clear and convincing evidentiary burden. And here it did not.
Okay, thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and then you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jonathan D. Wolf. I'm here representing the respondents, Janet Wayne and Dale Zick, as well as Sandra Stepes. As I get going here, I'm going to go a little bit out of order, I suppose, to respond to counsel. So I have to start with three factual, they're more than quibbles, I guess. They're kind of bones to pick with the summary there. First of all, on the attorney's fees, which we didn't get into a lot on the opening there, but there's not over $300,000 in attorney fee shifting here. The exact amount was $211,326.03. So that's indicative of the factual sloppiness that kind of permeates this entire appeal, in my opinion. I also want to make it unequivocally clear that counsel is wrong. I do not concede or agree that the drafter of an uncontested will who did not participate at all in the case is relevant to anything on appeal. And I want to take issue with the claim that there was no medical evidence. There were over 1,000 pages of medical records received into evidence as trial exhibits. And now Stanley didn't visit the doctor much in 2013, but the reason for that was because he was under the care of Joyce Wilson, one of appellants, who kept him from the doctor in 2013 while the appellants were effectuating the scheme. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Can I direct you to the issue of the lack of testamentary capacity? My concern with the district court's order is that it did not evaluate the legal standard for the in answering the question of lack of testamentary capacity. So I would like you to identify the factual basis for the lack of understanding by the decedent of the nature, situation, and extent of his property at the time of the 2013 will, and that he could hold that in his mind long enough to form a rational judgment. What is the evidence that was not the case?
Your Honor, there is actually overwhelming evidence that that was not the case. I think personally, the best evidence of that was the testimony of the trial witnesses over 5 days of trial. You can have family members testifying about the behavior.
Can you be specific, please?
Yes.
I'll
tell you the one piece that I think is actually probably the best, and you can ask me to go on if you want more. Stanley had a note that was made in 2013 that he did with one of the help of appellants, Joyce Wilson, that showed, it was purporting to show the acreage of the farmland he owned, what he owned, which parcels, he named the parcels. He got it all completely wrong. That's in one of our brief addendums. And he's doing this with the assistance of one of appellants. He didn't know the extent of his property. He didn't know the nature and bounty of what he had. Combine that with the fact that
that's a little bit of an overstatement there, counsel, right? Because he did list on that piece of paper the property that he did actually own. He just overstated what he owned. He thought he owned more than what was on that property. He didn't omit anything, did he?
He I believe he did. And Your Honor, I wasn't the trial court counsel either, so I might not be as familiar with the omissions. I believe he did, though. And I think what you're referencing was actually in Joyce Wilson's handwriting. Not that I know that there were findings about whose handwriting was whose. If you look at it, you can make a pretty good assumption as to which was the Alzheimer's patient's handwriting, which wasn't. But I thought that note was a particularly good piece of evidence. But you have testimony from Janet, from Wayne, from Dale, from all of my clients saying that he was not in had capacity this time. Plus, he did have another medical event prior to 2013. That was, I believe it was an aneurysm. After that point, he required 24-hour care for the rest of his life.
But that's not my question. My question is, what is the evidence at the time of the making of the 2013 will that he was unable to hold in his mind long enough the extent of his assets such that he could make a disposition?
Your Honor, when asked questions by his attorney, Mr. Luthner, at the time, he did not respond verbally, not once. Bill Luthner could not testify to hearing one word from Stanley in any of these meetings. I mean, that is circumstantial evidence. I mean, obviously, we can't get inside his head, but we have to look at the facts and make some assumptions. I mean, would somebody who knew and could rationalize and express the extent of his property sit there non-verbally saying nothing during multiple meetings with his attorney? I mean, I think that is pretty good. I don't even know if it's circumstantial evidence because he's sitting there in the room with Mr. Luthner. And I also want to point out that Mr. Luthner offered no opinions as to the decedent's testamentary capacity. He probably should have realized that this was problematic and not drafted the estate planning documents, but he didn't get up and testify, "Oh yeah, I thought he had capacity." He was surprisingly straightforward with the fact that he drafted estate planning documents for a party who made no verbal communications to him whatsoever. So I think that is great influence. And also, Mr. Luthner testified that he was unaware of the decedent's medical condition when the decedent came in to visit him. He was unaware of his progressively advancing Alzheimer's. He was unaware of his dementia. So maybe he didn't have reason to inquire further, but I certainly think the fact that Stanley did not talk to his purported attorney at that time and was always accompanied by one of the appellants speaks volumes to whether this was his will, you know, or theirs, speaking of undue influence, and whether he could fairly evaluate the extent of what he owned and what he really wanted to do with it. I don't think any of us would go into an estate planning attorney and not say anything about what we actually wanted if we had capacity. Have I answered the question, Your Honor, to your satisfaction?
Go ahead. Keep going, counsel.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to get into the Judge Glaser's denial of appellant's motion for recusal. I think this is an easy question, but I think it's a very important question because the stakes are so high, given that this is already dragged on since 2017, and of course, a reversal would put us back essentially at square one. So the standard of review here, as was noted in counsel's arguments, is clear abuse of discretion. It's not de novo, as was briefed originally, but I think we've addressed that. So I think it's important to remember here that the appellants did not bring their motion for recusal until 7 months after Judge Glasrud brought up the issue, and they learned of the issue after Judge Glasrud had already ruled on contested issues in motions. So it should be barred on those grounds. They didn't, that, and that's where we get the bias standard. And you know, I think Judge Glasrud was very careful and cautious in which standard he was applying. But in our view, that's why you have to show actual bias, because he ruled on contested issues before appellants made their motion for recusal. They learned about this issue where his law partner drafted this document a decade and a half ago, a former law partner. They didn't do anything with it for 7 months. In fact, they said, that doesn't bother us. We're fine with that. 7 months later, they say, now we're bringing this. But of course, they'd already received several orders they didn't like at that point. But this issue is also not subject to appellate review, because appellants would have had to raise it in a motion for a new trial before bringing it in appeal to preserve it here. And I noted some case law in the brief, County of Hennepin, there are others, saying specifically for contesting the denial of a motion to recuse on appeal, you have to bring a motion for a new trial to even get that to the Court of Appeals. But beyond those two procedural bars, substantively, there's no way that Judge Glasrud's former law partner drafting estate planning documents that no one contested nearly a decade and a half prior could result in impropriety or the appearance of impropriety. That the former law partner, as was noted, did not participate in the case at all. Nothing. Appellants didn't even send him a subpoena. And the reason he didn't participate is because he's completely irrelevant to this case.
Well, counsel, a couple points there. One, he is, well, the district court left the door open for the parties to raise this issue later on. So I don't know if this is one where, I think this is a little bit more of an unusual case where the district court, I think, did realize that if the issue of the 2007 becomes more relevant or more prevalent, it might be one where I may need to recuse myself. It seemed like the district court left the door open to that. And second, the district court, with respect to the 2007, while that wasn't contested, it was relevant, very much so, because really the issue is the 2013 will, is that one valid, or is it the 2007 will valid? Which one essentially is the one that should be in place? So even though because of that, it was a relevant issue in this whole trial.
Well, Your Honor, I'll address those two separately. I think Judge Glasrud did leave the door open out of an abundance of caution. I think he was a particularly cautious judge in this, and that was probably good practice, especially in greater Minnesota. I mean, there's always something like this. The guy with the office next door to mine, his father is a tech trying to appear in front of all the time. I mean, it's a small legal community. So I think it was wise of him and prudent of him to leave it open. But as we saw, nothing came of it. His former law partner never was called on to participate in the case at all. And on the second issue related to that, I mean, yes, it is relevant in that the 2007 will became operative if the 2013 documents were invalidated. But as far as who the drafter of that will was, I don't know that that matters, because nobody was contesting those documents. Everybody agreed, including the appellants, that if the 2013 items were invalidated, the 27 documents were would be what took over. Nobody disputes that the decedent had capacity at that point. His medical event didn't come until after that, if that makes sense. I guess I will move on just a little bit here. I wanted to talk briefly about whether the attorney's fees can be awarded against appellants personally or whether the attorney's fees awarded must come from the estate itself, as the appellants are now arguing. First and foremost, again, this is something that the appellants did not raise below. So they're raising this argument for the first time on appeal here. And that right there is enough, I believe, to decide against them on that issue. But to humor the argument for a moment, let's say they had raised it below. Great deference, first of all, is given to a district court's award of attorney's fees. And the behavior at issue below here with appellant's conduct or misconduct is egregious. Some of the most egregious I've seen. I haven't been doing this as long as I'm sure others involved here have. But the district court judge noted that appellants were lying on the stand. Obviously and apparently they were taking money from a deceased person purportedly for his care for months after he died, swearing at and threatening the court-appointed neutral, Judge Valand, when he was trying to help distribute personal property. I mean, this is egregious misconduct. There are 5 pages of these findings in the district court's findings. Clearly, there was a basis for a fee award as a sanction.
Counsel, actually, let me stop you there. What is the basis? What's the legal basis for the attorney fee award?
I believe, Your Honor, that my opinion, and we briefed all three of them, but I think the inherent powers of the court is the best one.
We generally follow the American rule of there has to be either an explicit statute or something on which to base, or if there isn't, each side pays their own attorney fees. That's the American rule.
We generally do follow that, but there are exceptions to that, and one is the inherent powers of a probate court in particular to address misconduct in a case before it. And there's numerous cases cited in the briefs about that.
But if there are attorney fees, those attorney fees go to the probate. They don't go to the other party.
Yes, but in this case, there is the statute that allows a fee award for benefiting the estate, and we did argue that below because you argue all the arguments you have, and that was one of them. This is obviously a more generous fee award than that. But
is your position that the attorney fee award is a Rule 11 sanction?
It is a sanction, and yes, it could be a Rule 11 sanction. It could be a sanction based on the inherent powers of the court to address misconduct. We didn't make a Rule 11 motion. The district court can make those fee awards on its own, but I think the issue was conduct, and that's why the district court awarded its fees, and it uses the word conduct.
I mean, unfortunately, there is conduct that occurs with unnerving frequency that is potentially sanctionable or potentially, the inherent powers of the court may choose to take some action, but there still has to be a basis for the action. I don't see where in the district court's order it set forth the basis of its action in awarding the attorney fees. Or a statute or common law.
I do think the district court was maybe a little sloppy in giving their legal basis. I've given several that I think you could uphold the fee award on the basis of. So I ask you to do that. I see I'm running out of time here. I just want to end by saying we're begging not to give the appellants kind of another straight thread to start pulling out in this case, because that's what they've been doing all along, and I thank you for hearing me out on this. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to try to confine my remarks to what we just discussed at the very end there regarding the issue of attorney's fees, because we didn't take that up during my initial argument. And I really do think that the question that Your Honors have posed, which is what is the basis for this extraordinary award of attorney's fees and costs against clients individually rather than against the estate itself, which plainly would have some basis under Minnesota law, hits the nail on the head. If this is in fact a sanctions order, as respondents, counsel contends, in an effort to salvage this award, we shouldn't be left to guess what the factual basis is. That, you know, goes to the very heart of the matter, which is, if this was intended to be a sanctions award, there's an essential requirement of due process that is fundamentally missing. The word sanctions was never mentioned or uttered at trial. You can search the trial transcript. It's not there. There was no order to show cause that was ever issued. There was no motion for sanctions that was ever brought. In fact, when the respondents submitted their proposed findings of fact following trial, they didn't seek the imposition of attorney's fees directly on my clients. They requested those fees be paid from the estate, which again, under 524.3-720, that section of the probate code regarding allocation of attorney's fees in estate litigation, is the statutorily appropriate approach, at least when you can show that there's been a benefit to the estate. It does not authorize the shifting that occurred here. And this is no ordinary fee award. Not only does it include $211,000 in respondents' attorney's fees, which I might add, based on the record before the court, it's simply rubber stamped. There was an affidavit submitted by respondents' counsel that attached no itemized invoices. It's certainly a record that would not meet the requirements of Rule 119 under the general rules of practice, which govern the approval and allowance of attorney's fees in contested litigation. Where I'm getting the extra $90,000, which I got called out on at the outset of respondents' argument, is that if you look at exhibits 1A, 1B, and 1C to that February 2020 order, you can see within those exhibits that the court has assessed a further 1/3 to each of my clients of the entire fees and costs incurred by the personal representative and his counsel, as well as the Value Consulting Group, which was an expert consulting firm originally retained by respondents. The entire cost of this litigation, over $300,000, is being assessed. And while the court may well have been dissatisfied and certainly expressed that dissatisfaction with my clients in its order, it did not provide them with the reasonable notice and opportunity to respond to those allegations and to have their proverbial day in court where they could explain why their conduct, if the court felt it merited a sanctions award, did not. And further, an opportunity to challenge the exorbitant amount of fees ultimately assessed against them. They were never given that opportunity. And that is a further reason why the procedural default arguments that really respond in their briefing, as well as their argument here today, really, really rely on, simply don't pass the straight face test. How were my clients to expect what occurred by way of both of these post-trial orders?
So, counsel, I have a separate question for you, and sure. You only have a minute left. Let's assume for the sake of argument that we concluded that the decedent had indeed, that the district court did not clearly err in determining that decedent lacked testamentary capacity. Would you agree that if we were to conclude that he certainly then did not have the capacity to make a gift, which is a higher standard?
You know, Your Honor, I believe that is an accurate restatement of the relative standards of capacity under Minnesota law as I understand them.
Okay, thank you.
Again, though, for the reasons that I've argued, I think, you know, and again, as to the gifting capacity issue, again, the Gellert decision we cite indicates once again that the evidentiary standard is not preponderance of the evidence. It's clear and convincing evidence. The record simply does not support a finding of clear and convincing evidence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for the extensive briefing and the arguments. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory timeframe. And-